The matter of State versus Paul Canera. May we please have appearances of counsel? Good morning and welcome, counsel. Mr. Otero, please.
If I may please reserve a few moments for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Thank you. The state would like to start its argument, maybe a bit unusually, by expressing its gratitude to the court. State understands that its motion to accelerate was both unusual and asked this court to act with a speed that's uncommon in appellate matters. The state appreciates that this court was willing to grant its motion and hear this case so quickly. Nonetheless, the state is now here before this court asking for more, for the reversal of an order of suppression that represents a break in the chain of an almost 50 years of unbroken precedent in this country and in the state. Since Tyler in 1978, and is adopted by our court, our appellate court in 2007 in Imodio, courts have recognized that fire suppression and investigation activities can, and under the right set of circumstances, meet the requirements for a warrantless search or seizure. Such circumstances were present almost 7 years ago on Tilton Drive. During the less than 40 minutes that preceded the successful seizure of the DVR issues, the officers were facing an exigency that objectively did not permit them time to secure a warrant. The residence was on fire, and that fire had started in the basement, but had now spread through the house, and the flames were visible through the roof when the officers arrived. Despite being pretty quickly aware of a potential suspicious origin for the fire after locating that partially melted gas can near the small but quickly extinguished fire at the garage entrance, Sergeant Malone rightly prioritized the safety of his officers and the community. Sergeant Malone prioritized directing his officers away from the residence before the arrival of firefighters and hose trucks because, as he testified, they were not equipped to handle a fire of that size, particularly not one so close to the house's gas meter. There was nothing offensive to the Fourth Amendment about law enforcement first focusing on evacuating the neighbors for their safety and ensuring that the street was clear for soon to be arriving fire trucks. As the body-worn camera videos here show, it was only after the arrival of firefighters from multiple firehouses that Sergeant Malone believed that the risk to his officers was mitigated sufficiently enough for them to start investigating at the garage, to have this scene secured off by police tape, to seek out fire marshals for consultation about their observations, and to secure from the house that the lower court found was still on fire a DVR that could contain a recording of the arsonist, and that the Canero family told the police was located in the back of the attached garage near a shared wall with the residence proper. During the 7.5 minutes it took the officers to retrieve this DVR, a plethora of electronics it was located amongst, the fluid and dynamic circumstances caused by the still active fire continued. Power was lost to the house, plunging the garage into darkness. Utility workers were on scene. Fire hoses ran over the front lawn and into the residence through the front door. Firefighters' power tools could be heard being deployed, and a fire truck's ladder was now over the roof of the house. In finding these dynamic and evolving circumstances were not sufficiently exigent, the lower court did not identify a pocket of time in this timeline that provided officers the sufficient time to obtain a warrant it acknowledged would have taken more than 7.5 minutes to get. Instead, the lower court fell into a trap against which this court and the United States Supreme Court have long warned against. It reviewed the facts not from the perspective of the officers on the scene, but through the safety of 20/20 hindsight. Knowing with a certainty it could only have, with a distance of almost 7 years, that the residence of which this garage was a connected part would survive the fire and remain structurally intact. In finding the facts before it more analogous to those in Clifford, a case in which law enforcement waited over 6 hours post-fire before entering the residence for no better reason than they had other assignments, the lower court substituted its luxury of time for calm reflection and sustained deliberation for Sergeant Malone's prioritization of officer safety and quick but still reasonable on-scene decision making. In coming before this court, the state is not asking for any changes in the rule of Tyler, a rule that has worked for almost 50 years. The state simply asks this court to remind lower courts that exigency in the fire context does not require flames to be licking at the area to be searched. Does not require movie star level acts of heroics. that exigency can and should be found under facts like those presented here. Thank you for allowing me that opening statement. I'm happy to answer any questions the court might have.
Mr. Otero, how big is the home measured in feet from one end to the other?
The testimony from Sergeant Malone, it's a bit confusing, but he says both 30 and 60 feet, and I think 60 feet is potentially the correct one. We have photographs that are in evidence that show that the fire was at the back corner of the residence, the fire that had started in the basement, and that the garage is on the other side of that residence, but still attached to the main structure.
Back corner refers to which corner?
If you are looking at the house from the road, it would be the back corner on the right, and the garage is on the left.
So the far right end of the house?
Yes.
And how big in feet is the garage from the garage door till the entrance into the home?
I don't believe that was testified to in feet, but you can see on the body-worn camera here that the location where this DVR is located is a refrigerator that's against the back wall. And you can see the entrance to the main house itself on that body-worn camera. It's adjacent to the location that was being searched.
Do you know how far the refrigerator, that door that connects the garage and the home to the place of the fire was approximately?
Again, the testimony we have from Sergeant Malone is an estimation of between 30 and 60 feet.
And that wall just, I'm sorry. No, that,
I thought you said 30 to 60 feet represented length of the entire house.
His testimony was asked to estimate at one point says 30 feet and another point says 60 feet. So the state's belief from that testimony is that that's some duration. And again, the court, or the state would point to the court to the photographs that were moved into evidence and are part of the record here.
You'd have to back out the length of the garage because that's where the DVR was.
No, the garage was in against the wall that was adjacent to the house, not closest to the garage itself. Oh, you're asking to subtract the length? Yeah, it's not super clear, but you can see the photographs. This is a pretty, for at least for Monmouth County, I would say, a pretty standard colonial style home with a two-car garage.
Is it possible that the inconsistency of the testimony is that the entire length of the house is 60 feet, but the distance between the refrigerator, DVR on top of it, through that wall to the active fire was more like 30 feet? Does that make sense in reading that testimony?
That is a possibility. Again, I just don't want to misstate the testimony. I want to be accurate with the court that there are those two distance estimations right in the record.
And is it clear from the testimony that this wall that separated the house and the garage, that's part of the main house. So if the fire ongoing in the house had continued to spread, it would have or could have presumably taken out that wall.
Yes, I mean, the testimony and the photographs are clear. This is an attached garage that it shares a wall with the residence. This isn't a separate structure from the main house itself.
You said earlier that officers were seeking a DVR, and you said that could contain a recording of the arsonist. So is it your perspective that at that point, they were looking not necessarily to find out what caused the fire, but who caused the fire?
I think it would be both things. I think they had probable cause. That's not in dispute before this court. They had a fire that was happening at one location of the house near the gas meter. When the officers arrived, they had a second fire that was at the garage they extinguished. They had a melted gas can that was located there, as well as scorch marks on one of the vehicles parked outside. They were looking for evidence related to this fire cause, presumably, and the officers knew that the surveillance cameras were located right there. And so they were looking for a video that could identify the arsonist as well as show what had occurred.
Do you think it's critical what they were looking for? I mean, if cause and origin are one issue, and if assailant or potential defendant or target is another issue, don't you think it matters what the purpose of that search was?
I don't, Your Honor, nor do I think that the law allows for such a distinction. It's clear that it's clear that when you're talking about cause and origin, and when you're looking at cases like Tyler, like Imodio, that they're looking for cause and origin, but at least in one of those cases, they also had a dead body that they were investigating, and they were sorting through the debris, and that's going to give them evidence of more than that. Ultimately, when we're talking about exigency, and kind of where I stumbled before, is when we look at cases like Tyler, when it talks about exigency, it's talking about things like we need to find out who did this in order to protect the community from arsonists. So I would not say that the law with regard to fire investigations and exigency up until this point would allow for a distinction between cause and origin versus video evidence of the person who started the fire in light of the way that exigency and fire investigation situations has been crafted.
Couldn't that also be because part of an exigency analysis is safeguarding the evidence itself? So in a number of the cases that have talked about fire, it has held that for purposes of investigating how a fire has started, the police can search the home without a warrant, even a pretty long time after the fire has been fully put out. So in Taylor, for example, it's a furniture store, not a home, but the fire starts at 2 a.m. It is fully put out by 4 a.m. And then there is searching that is still happening at 9 a.m. And the Supreme Court says all of that is totally fine for purposes of figuring out how the fire started. In this case, though, regardless of whether it was to figure out how the fire started or who started the fire was still ongoing. So a big purpose of the search would be safeguarding the DVR from water damage or steam damage or itself burning up, because there was still a fire that was happening. Whereas in Tyler and Clifford and Imodio, we're talking about searches that happen after the fire has been put out. Is that correct?
I think that's both accurate and that's consistent with Sergeant Malone's testimony. Sergeant Malone consistently testifies that, and I understand subjective intent is not as relevant as objective circumstances, but Sergeant Malone consistently testifies that was his purpose and his thought process on ordering his officers in at that time when firefighters were on the scene. The fire, as you said, Your Honor, was not fully extinguished, but he felt that there was, again, a mitigated risk at that point to seize the DVR, and again, for his stated purpose of preserving that evidence from destruction.
One thing that is striking to me in the body, the longer body cam video, longer of the two videos, is that they refer to the defendant as the homeowner. And should we ask the homeowner this? Should we ask the homeowner that? And at one point, they're looking at the evidence that someone had started a fire right at the corner of the garage, and there was I guess gas and some damage on cars. And I forget exactly what it said, but it's almost, are you going to tell the homeowner this? Well, no. And is it the state's position that during this critical period, there was no focus whatsoever on defendant as a potential suspect?
Yes, at this time, and I think, again, clear from Sergeant Malone's testimony that the defendant was seen as a homeowner. The state didn't have any suspicion with regard to him as a perpetrator of the offense, I would say for several hours, if not days.
It sounds to me like you are asking for a blanket rule that just says fire, warrantless search. It doesn't sound to me like it matters where the fire is, how strong the fire is, or how close the fire is to being put out, or whether the area to be searched is under control. You're just saying fire, warrantless search. Am I wrong?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I believe that is a misstatement of the state's position. The state is aware that exigent circumstances is always a totality of the circumstances test. That's what the Supreme Court said in Tyler, that's what our court adopted in Imodio. I think there is this quote from Clifford that our appellate division cites to in Imodio. It says that even though it's recognizing that the extinguishing of the fire doesn't necessarily dissipate the exigency, it says additional investigation begun after a fire has been extinguished and fire and police officials have left the scene generally must be made pursuant to a warrant or identification of some new exigency. And so I would say even in that quote, as this court, when citing Riley in State versus Manning, said that there are certain circumstances that we all kind of, with exceptions, and we can all think of alternative scenarios that are just kind of exigent, but we always need to analyze the facts. So this court said child abduction. This court said active shooter. This court said bomb threats. And Tyler and the line of cases that the state is asking this court to adopt, I think, are similar in that line. It's not asking for a per se test or a blanket rule, but it is saying that this is a fact. This is a factor, and you have to consider it. And the factors here were not properly, the state would submit, considered by the lower court.
The factors. Mm-hmm. What are the factors that a court would look at to determine that even though a fire is ongoing, a search warrant would be appropriate? What would determine that?
That a search warrant was appropriate?
What would determine that even though a fire was ongoing, a search warrant would be appropriate?
I mean, very easy off the top, the state versus, or the Clifford quote that I just read. If fire personnel and law enforcement personnel had left this, if the fire was fully extinguished, and fire and law enforcement had left the scene, then you would need a warrant.
That's my question. What are the factors? If you're not looking for a blanket rule that says fire means warrantless search, what are the factors that would determine that even though a fire is ongoing, a warrant would still be required? What would we look to?
So I think we would look to the totality of the circumstances, as we do in every exigent circumstances analysis. So things like, is the fire actively ongoing? Again, I think you can't get away from the fact that if the fire is completely extinguished and police and law enforcement or police and fire have left the scene, that cuts against it.
Is asking you to assume that the fire is ongoing and still give an example of when a warrant would be required. Could it be, for example, a 50,000 square foot warehouse where there is a tiny fire that is ongoing in one corner and then 50,000 or, you know, many thousands of feet away on the other corner?
Separate structures on, let's say you had a large farm, if there was a fire in one of the outbuildings that wasn't affecting the farmhouse, then yes, you would need a warrant for that different location. Structure? Again, I want to answer the court's question. It's difficult because we could probably, as Justice Wiener Apter said, you can imagine a situation where there is a large enough structure that the distance is the same as if they were separate structures. I think the fact that this is the same structure matters. Again, when the lower court said or found that the garage was structurally intact, he's only finding that because we know that it remains so the entire time. Exigent circumstances is always going to come down to risks and probabilities. No court has, nor should this court continue or depart from that, is say that there needs to be a situation where, unless the fire is on that shared wall, officers need to get a warrant, because the reality is in that situation, no officer would be going in. We know here that Sergeant Malone's first concern was, as every sergeant should be, the safety of his officers. So I think you would be looking at, you'd have to look at officer safety. And so whether the fire is in the same structure or in a separate structure, whether the fire is ongoing is going to matter. And I think the fire ongoing is a highly relevant factor. Again, that's why the courts that have dealt with this in the past have always said, you know, when the fire's out, fire personnel and law enforcement have left, absent some renewed exigency, that's when they're saying to get a warrant. But that's not a per se rule.
Is it significant that this was a fire, there was an indication to the officers because of the gas can that this was a fire started by accelerants?
I think, again, that's a factor that goes into it. It shows, I mean, I think this would be a completely different scenario if you didn't have that fire by the garage, where you just had a residence fire that started in the early morning hours and you had no indication as to whether or not this was arson. In that case, maybe the law enforcement doesn't even know or have any criminal suspicions until later. And at that point, yes, a warrant would have to be secured.
You discussed Sergeant Malone's concerns. He said his first concern was safety and security of the officers. But he was asked that question in trial and at the transcript at 2T104. And the question was, at the time you told him to get the DVR out of the garage, what were your concerns? And his response was, the concerns were that there were suspicious circumstances surrounding the cause of the fire. And I was concerned the evidence was going to be destroyed, the potential to find out who did it. So it doesn't sound to me like his response was that his initial and immediate and primary concern was the safety and security of the officers. It sounds to me like his primary concern was, I need to find out who started this fire.
I think that's a bit of a misreading of the transcript. Sergeant Malone often testifies before that about his immediate concerns being with regard to the safety of his officers. Those concerns change and he's able to shift to the DVR once the fire official firefighters are there and he knows that they are dealing with the fire. Why this is relevant is because in this totality of the circumstances analysis, when we're looking at whether or not the officers had time to obtain a warrant, we have to look at what other activities the officers were doing that were taking away time from potentially getting a warrant. This court found that in State versus Zalkberg when it was a motor vehicle collision and we were discussing getting time to get a telephonic warrant for a blood sample. The court found significant that the officers first had to prioritize clearing the road, dealing with the injured passengers that involved the jaws of life. This court even found the fact that the officer had to wait at the hospital for over an hour before he was even given access to the defendant didn't negate exigent circumstances. This court found that it was appropriate for officers to first prioritize safety, community safety, their safety, and do those activities first before they turn to criminal investigatory tasks.
A reasonable estimate for the amount of time it would take to get a warrant at 5:30 in the morning to prepare the affidavit, to get it approved by a supervisor, and then to get a judge on the line and make a ruling.
Unfortunately, the time estimates that this court set forth in State versus Witt are still the reasonable time estimates. 30 minutes would be probably one of the fastest warrants I've ever obtained. And Witt, this court said it could take up to 1 to 2 hours, and that's accurate. As Your Honor mentioned, we can't really technology our way out of a passage of time. Warrants would require Sergeant Malone to have contacted an on-call assistant prosecutor, advise them of what the facts were. That takes time. The assistant prosecutor would then call the county radio room in Monmouth County in order to have them reach out to the on-call judge. That takes time. I've had that take up to 20 minutes from when I contacted county dispatch to when the on-call judge called me back. Then the state would speak, the assistant prosecutor would speak to the judge, advise them of at least minimal facts in, the name of the affiant, where we were looking to search. And then the state would then call the officer back, advise them that they can contact or call into the radio room. And then now you're starting the warrant process. That's going to take however long it takes to discuss the facts, which depending on the complexity of the facts can just take shorter or longer. So 30 minutes on the best day, everything goes right, and the facts are very short to 2 hours is an accurate estimate of the longest.
Is there anything in the record that we can look to suggest what the level of communication was between fire and police before the search was conducted in terms of alerts regarding where the fire was, what was happening with it on the other side of the structure?
I think the body-worn camera, I would submit to Your Honor, shows that, but it also shows that this is a dynamic, fluid scene. You see Sergeant Malone oftentimes trying to find the fire marshals to convey the information that they've received. And you have firefighters that are coming out on the front lawn, firefighters that are inside, and ultimately Sergeant Malone makes, he says the fire marshal or the fire officials, the head on scene, are wearing the white helmets. He speaks to two of them because he can't find the officer or the fire official that he's more familiar with. So,
but there isn't anything on the video of Sergeant Malone asking for information about what's happening with the activity on the other side while they're in the garage area. So there isn't an active call that's recorded saying, we're about to go into the structure. Somebody let me know what's happening on the other side, right? Unless I missed something.
There's not that, but I think that's not a function of some deficiency by the police officers that should be held against them, and a function of the fact that this was an active fire scene.
Aren't the firefighters busy containing the fire? Because what you can see on the video, I think about five or six minutes before the DVR is removed, you can see smoke emanating from, you can see smoke billowing from the roof of the house. You can see, the electricity goes off in the garage. I'm guessing that's because there's a fire in the house. The electricity goes off before, while they're searching for the DVR. And then even right after the DVR is removed, you can hear what I believe is the saw that the firefighters are using to, release more smoke from the structure. So it seems as though the firefighters, I'm guessing, were occupied and not really in a position to give a full debrief at the time when they were still trying to contain an active fire.
I mean, not to repeat or use the same words, but when I mean, kind of the good thing about body-worn cameras is the court can see exactly what the officers saw and what they were doing. This was a very dynamic scene. I mean, the lower court doesn't find that the fire is extinguished. The lower court finds that the fire here is still being fought, and you can see it yourself. When the officer comes out, Officer Marino comes out with the DVR, there's now the fire truck's ladder is extended over the pitch of the roof. As Your Honor mentioned, you can hear the firefighting activity still occurring. And so, while I agree, there's nothing specific in the record, I think, again, the reason for that is because of the dynamic situation. Again, being able to get one of the two fire officials to have that communication, I think the record bears out is quite difficult.
But I guess I'm trying to square two pieces of information, because your suggestion was that there was a concern for officer safety, right, before entering the structure. And I'm not suggesting that they had to pull fire officials from their duties of fighting the fire to get that information, but there were enough personnel available to relay that information to the officers about to go into the structure. And that didn't seem to happen. I mean, if they were so concerned for their safety, then I think there should have been some level of gathering of information before entering to say, where is the fire? Is it getting close to that wall? Can you see it from that side? Something to suggest that they were in any kind of danger. They would have wanted to forecast that before walking into the building.
I think that's very much something that we in a courtroom almost 7 years later can think about. I don't know that that is reasonable for officers at the time to do. Sergeant Malone made the decision to have the officers gather the evidence and go in and seize the DVR at a time that he knew that he could see for himself without talking to fire officials that fire mitigation efforts were being made, that mitigated the risks to his officers, whereas when he arrived and you had the uncontrolled fire, because there's no firefighters on scene, by the gas meter, he wasn't willing to take that risk. We ask officers to risk their safety all the time. The state, I guess, is not here saying exigent circumstances doesn't involve any risk to officers. And I agree that there was a risk to the officers here. Exigent circumstances allows officers to mitigate those risks.
And Malone was walking around. That's very telling from the video. He is really virtually everywhere in the front area of this house and garage. You don't see him going behind the house, but he's aware, he's communicating as he walks around, and he certainly has a good view because the body cam provides a good view of what's going on.
And to be clear, I think there's only 5 or 6 police officers on scene total, and many of them are involved in stationary tasks. Again, you can see, you know, they have to talk to neighbors, they have to make sure the street stays open, and you can see that street is pretty much covered. There's a neighbor who has a fire truck or fire SUV on their front lawn, probably much to their chagrin when they woke up. I mean, this, again, I hate to say it, I hate to keep saying dynamic, but it's a very dynamic scene. And in total, we're talking about 40 minutes. And I think that's really the 40 minutes is when, you know, the officer has the DVR. I think they go in to get it before 40 minutes have even passed from arrival on the scene. And again, I think that's kind of the state's difficulty with the lower court's ruling is in comparing this fact pattern to Clifford, a case that we can all agree is not exigent. In Clifford, you have, you know, again, an officer that just does other tasks and shows up 6 hours later without a warrant. And this court in State versus Manning kind of told law enforcement, if you have time to get a warrant, if you're getting other warrants, you need to get a warrant. And if 6 hours had passed here, the state would not be before this court, but we're talking about from arrival on scene to seizure of the DVR, 40 minutes.
Clifford actually wasn't even a case of exigency because, quote, the state had there was no challenge to the state's court's finding that there was no exigent circumstances justifying the search of the Clifford's home. Instead, the state's argument in Clifford was that there should be a blanket exemption from the warrant requirement for all administrative investigations into the cause and origin of a fire, which the Supreme Court refused. So Clifford wasn't even an exigency case. The request in Clifford was, we want a separate rule. Administrative searches were a big thing that the U.S. Supreme Court was ruling on in many contexts at that time. And the state was asking for a blanket rule that for an administrative search that did not require a warrant into anything related to a fire, having nothing to do with exigency at all.
Yeah, that is a completely accurate recitation. Ultimately, the Clifford court does discuss exigent circumstances, even though it's not being argued because it it's on its face not exigent circumstances, because it does reaffirm Tyler and Tyler's holding, which again is all that this court, all that this state is asking this court to do.
Are the Manning factors the guiding principles here?
Yes, again, like I know we're talking about this in the fire investigation context, and I don't want that to in any way lead the court astray that the state is asking for anything other than like exigency is exigency, but the lower court's evaluation of the exigency of the circumstances here was too strict, was too guided by 2020 hindsight, and didn't accord sufficient weight to the circumstances, the totality of the circumstances that the officers were facing here.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, counsel?
No, thank you very much. I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you, Mr. Carosha.
Good morning, your honors, and may it please the court. In the face of an active fire near a gas meter and with suspicions of arson, Sergeant Malone acted in an objectively reasonable manner when he had his officers secure defendant's DVR with assistance from defendant and his daughter. That action is doubly justified given the limited nature of the retrieval, which was to prevent the evidence from being damaged until police could seek consent from defendant later on to search the DVR. And at the time they did believe that he was a victim, not a suspect. Under these circumstances, this court should reverse the appellate division's decision on any of three grounds. The touchstone of each ground is the reasonableness of the police action at the time the action was made, not in hindsight. First, as has been discussed, the police acted reasonably by retrieving the DVR from the garage in light of the quickly evolving exigency created by the active fire. To do so was justified under Tyler. On top of that, given the known volatility of fires, the fact that the fire was near the gas line, and the presence of gasoline near the garage, a limited retrieval of the DVR after finding its location from defendant and his daughter was reasonable, especially given the early morning hour and impracticability of obtaining a warrant. Both courts below incorrectly relied on hindsight and misapplied Tyler and Clifford, among other exigency principles, in suppressing the DVR. Second, regardless of whether exigent circumstances existed, defendant's verbal and written consent to search the DVR was attenuated from that challenged conduct. It would be inappropriate to apply the exclusionary rule under these circumstances because each prong of the attenuation test is satisfied. Defendant consented a full 6 hours later, still at the scene.
Let me ask you, is that an argument, the attenuation argument and the consent argument, is that an argument that the state is still pressing, or has that been essentially abandoned by the state?
No, it was not in the motion for leave to appeal before this court, but it was ruled upon below, and the record is fully developed on this issue. So the Attorney General would submit that this court could still look at the attenuation issue. His defendant's express consent to search the DVR was an intervening
circumstance. Does that mean they're pressing it, or they aren't?
Oh, the state did not include it in their motion for leave to appeal. This is the Attorney General argument. His express consent to search the DVR was an intervening circumstance. And third, no misconduct, let alone flagrant misconduct, took place. The officers went to the exact spot pointed out by defendant and his daughter, securing the DVR until it was practicable to ask for defendant's consent to search. And third, by giving police the specific location of the DVR and his daughter, defendant and his daughter impliedly consented to the police securing it. While the Attorney General does acknowledge that this argument was not made before the trial court, the record is also developed on this point. The testimony and the body-worn camera footage presented below clearly show the interaction. Defendant and his daughter directed the officers to the DVR's exact location while they remained nearby. The police therefore reasonably believed that defendant consented to the retrieval. On each of these grounds, the police action in this case was reasonable. The panel's decision should therefore be reversed and the surveillance footage admitted at trial. Thank you. The Attorney General would welcome the court's questions.
Anything you'd like to add, counsel?
No, I mean, just to go to some of the one or two of the questions that were addressed to the state. I think that with the Manning factors against the Tyler and Clifford sort of case law, I think that they're synergized. So we have the Manning factors here, which the court goes through. And when we talk about the factor, when we're talking about the threat that evidence would be destroyed and the urgency of the situation and the time it would have taken to secure a warrant, I think that Tyler, especially Tyler and Imodio, go towards those three factors and strongly weigh in favor of the state.
But all is it the AG's position that all of the Manning factors should be applied?
Well, there was the one the fact that he was not armed and did not pose an imminent danger.
Well, perhaps that weighs in favor of defendant in that case, or
certainly, whatever. Certainly. But the relevant, as the court, the trial court noted, the three disputed factors were urgency of the situation, the time it would have taken to secure a warrant, and the threat that the evidence would be destroyed. And it's right. The attorney.
But I mean, doesn't Manning set out the full set of factors that the court should consider, whether or not they're disputed? Whether the dispute is obviously part of the analysis, but I was a little confused by the briefing in that regard, because it's, I thought that Manning set forth factors that all are relevant to the court's consideration, whether or not there's a factual dispute as to a given factor.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. It's just that Tyler and Imodio go specifically to those that I had noted that were disputed in this case specifically. But certainly all of the factors are relevant and to the court's analysis. And I think that's it. I think the Attorney General would just ask this court to reverse the appellate division's decision. Thank you very much.
Ms. Mastalone.
Good morning, and may it please the court. We do agree with the state that under the right set of circumstances, exigency at a fire scene can, of course, be found. But we disagree with the state that exigency can be found here under these set of circumstances. For those reasons, that's why we're asking that the trial court and the appellate division's orders be affirmed, because those courts appropriately recognized that fire scenes are not per se exigencies, that it is a totality of the circumstances analysis. And under that analysis, given the very unique, distinct facts in this case, there was no exigency that permitted the warrantless conduct. One thing I would really like to clarify at the outset is the test that should be applied here for exigency, and as well as how Tyler and Clifford specifically come into play. So with respect to the test that this court, like the lower courts, should administer, it is the Manning test. It's exigency. It's all of the factors. This court, like the lower courts, should look at the urgency of the situation, the time that it would have taken to secure a warrant, the threat of the evidence being destroyed or lost or removed from the scene, whether anyone was endangered unless immediate action was taken, whether the premises is conducive to effective surveillance while the warrant is procured, whether the suspect, if there is a suspect, was armed and dangerous, the time of entry, the seriousness of. Now, with that said, Tyler and Clifford are relevant because our United States Supreme Court, when they addressed those cases, they wanted to look at how exigency comes into play with respect to non-police actors, specifically in the firefighting function. And Tyler discusses that. Tyler explicitly says, we are here to address the firefighting function and how that works in the context of firefighting exigency. In other words, we know that the Fourth Amendment applies to police officers. We know that the Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable searches and seizures and entries by law enforcement. But what hadn't yet been addressed until Tyler and subsequently Clifford is, but what rights do firefighter officials have? Fire officials, fire investigators, those who are responding to a fire emergency. And the court said,
I think I have to disagree when it comes to Tyler, because it was not only firefighting personnel. There was a police detective there. The police detective was the one who took the two containers at 4 a.m. And then the police detective is the one who returned with the assistant fire chief at 9 a.m., which was 5 hours after the fire had been extinguished and the building was empty. And they found additional evidence there. So I just don't see in Tyler that it's about only how does the Fourth Amendment apply to non-police detectives.
That's exactly right. But the distinction there is that the police were assisting the firefighting investigators who had not yet determined origin and cause of the fire. So in other words, the court is saying, again, we know that the Fourth Amendment applies to police, but what rights do firefighters and fire officials have? They have the right to show up at the scene, enter the premises, and extinguish the fire, right? That's one right. They also have the right, and this is where the quote comes into play about the dousing of the last flame, right? That's not where the exigency ends. We concede that because fire investigators are also tasked with determining the origin and cause of the fire. And in doing so, oftentimes it takes longer than it does to extinguish the fire, so they have to remain on scene for a reasonable period of time to find out the origin and the cause. And in both Tyler and Clifford, that's what the fire investigators were there to do, and the police were there to assist.
In this instance, the argument is there was an additional reason, and that was preservation of evidence in the face of an ongoing fire, correct?
Yes, that's correct. And
so tell us, how far was the DVR on top of the refrigerator from the site of the ongoing fire? Can you give us an approximation in feet based on the record?
I can. And that's because the state didn't offer that into evidence. I agree with the state that what we have is approximately 60 feet, but it's the state's burden. It's the state's burden to prove the exigency and to establish the facts. And
I thought they said approximately 60 feet for the entire length of the house. Did I hear that incorrectly?
No, that's, I believe, what was established, and that's all that was established.
So that's, plus we have photos of the garage, which shows that this was at the point closest to the living quarters of the home, correct?
So yes.
It's less than 60 feet based on the record.
Based on the record, yes. It's
the entirety of this courtroom is just shy of 60 feet. That means that the DVR was quite close to an ongoing fire.
Sure. I think, though, there's two important distinctions. And the first is that, and it's understandable why the fact that there's a fire alone is alarming, right? That's alarming. But that's why we don't have a per se rule, because we have to look at all of the factors in the totality. The facts matter. The circumstances matter.
Precisely, because we're talking about the particular dynamics of this particular property. This is not this is not a castle. This is a home that is apparently around 60 feet in length.
Yes.
And do you dispute that the refrigerator is up against a wall that is the opposite side of which was in the residence?
I do not dispute that.
Okay.
However, at the time of the search, Sergeant Malone conceded that the garage was intact, that the garage was structurally sound, that the fire was not anywhere near the garage, that the garage was undisturbed by the fire, that he never saw the fire get close to the garage, that it had a separate roof, the fire was on the opposite end, that he was not worried the garage was going to explode or the house was going to be engulfed in flames, that no one was injured in the garage, no fire in the garage, the roof wasn't caving in, no exposed wires, no blatant hazards in the garage. And similarly, the trial court found, these are quotes, the garage here was neither compromised nor actively threatened at the time of the DVR seizure. By the time of the seizure, the garage was no longer an area of active suppression or investigation tied to imminent danger. There is no evidence that suppression crews were preparing to douse the garage, that the DVR was exposed to active fire damage, or that the time-sensitive degradation of the evidence of the device was underway. The evidence shows the garage had stabilized and was not under active suppression. The garage was located at the farthest possible point from the remaining fire. The garage was no longer an area of active firefighting with complete absence of visible smoke or flame.
But the farthest possible point could have been 30 feet. I mean, we're not talking about 100 yards. We're talking about a structure that could have, as to which the flames may have reached that garage.
So it could have, right? But I think that's the point, is this court in State versus Nyama said that we don't know exactly what a robbery just occurred means. And common sense said that.
Is there really an analogy between a dispatcher's call that a robbery just occurred with police officers out on the highway and an ongoing fire, which is in the early stages of being suppressed, which is just inherently unpredictable? I just don't see the analogy there.
The analogy lies with respect to, if there's information missing in the record, we can't speculate and we can't generalize. And I think that that's what the state is really asking this court to do, because The state is saying, you know, that Sergeant Malone arrived unseen and he was just concerned. All of his concerns were extremely generalized, and we know that what we can't do is rely on generalizations to support exigency. There has to be something very fact-specific. Sergeant Malone's testimony—
Is it sufficiently fact-specific that a garage that's attached to a house and a house is on fire and it is unpredictable how that is going to go because fires are just inherently don't follow a written schedule. What is it that we need more than that, that's missing information in the record?
The missing information is, what was the actual status of this fire at the time of the search? At the time of the search—
You can hear, sorry, on the body-worn camera afterwards, the saws of the firefighters, which are intended, as far as I understood, to let smoke out. So we do know that the status of the firefighting is that it is active. There is an active fire. It has not been put out. Correct?
Right. So I think the fact that there's saws and there's ventilation, that's actually indicative of the fact that the fire is either almost fully suppressed or suppressed, because typically you're ventilating with the saws and opening up the area to let the smoke out afterward.
You can see smoke billowing, right?
Correct. Yes. And the trial court addressed that. The trial court said smoke can mean a lot of things. It could mean the fire's ongoing. It could mean the fire's out.
But the trial court also relied on information that the police could not have possibly had at the time, like the garage did not share a foundation with the main house, and the roof of the garage at no point thereafter was called into question. So that the police would never have known at the time, for example, that there was no shared foundation, correct? I think the trial court's specific word was that the basement didn't share a foundation with the garage. And because the fire was in the basement, and the basement didn't share a foundation with the garage, there was no threat to the garage. There was no way for the officers to know that at the time, right?
So that specific fact, possibly not. But I think the bigger point is that Sergeant Malone, at the very least, could have ascertained with a little more effort what a reasonable officer would have done under the circumstances before committing a warrantless intrusion into a home, is to ascertain, is this fire a risk to the garage? Is there may be an exigency here, but does that mean that there is an exigency over here?
So did he have an obligation? And you see from the body cam how really frantic this effort was. Did he have an obligation to find the senior firefighter on the scene and say, Give me a numerical assessment of the risk that this fire in the home is going to spread to the garage? Is that reasonable?
What's reasonable is that Sergeant Malone earlier, he testified that he knew the status of the fire earlier on because he had heard someone talk about it over the radio. So he didn't have to grab a firefighter that was actively firefighting the scene. But in fact, I mean, if you look at the body worn camera, there's like firefighters standing all around. He actually brought a firefighter over to the garage himself, and he was just trying to show the firefighter what his observations were. And the firefighters were essentially disinterested. But at the time that he had an opportunity when he brought that firefighter over to say, by the way, like, is there a concern about this area? And what we do know is what the firefighter did not say. The firefighter did not say, oh, you should back up, or like this area could catch on fire. We're concerned about the fire spreading. The firefighter's like, thanks for showing me. And that's pretty much it. So he did have an opportunity. That was several minutes before the search. That was right prior, maybe like 5 minutes before the search occurred. But there's many firemen standing around. And I think what the trial court looked at in assessing the totality was not just Sergeant Malone's testimony, but also, yes, the body-worn camera footage, which shows a complete absence of exigency in the garage area. There's no firefighting activity. There's no flame. You can't see smoke from the garage area. It's completely intact. There's like the firefighters are ignoring the area.
There's a complete exigency from the garage itself. Does that mean that only if the garage itself was on fire could the police go in in order to simply seize. They didn't search the DVD. They just want to protect it because they don't want it to be destroyed. Can they only do that if the garage is actively on fire or if someone is in the process right then of spraying water at the DVR?
No, but it's not extreme one way or the other, right? They can't only do it if the garage is on fire, but they also can't always do it if the main structure is on fire. Because again, you have to look at the size of the structure, the size of the flame, the active status of the flame, and then also on top of that.
Is it the same argument? I understand here it's an attached garage, and there was all this conversation with the trial court that, you know, they didn't share a foundation and the roof was structurally intact, etc. What if this was, you know, the kitchen is in one part of the house and then the fire is in a different part of the house? Is your argument the same, that the police wouldn't be able to go grab something from the kitchen in order to protect it and make sure that the evidence is not destroyed if the fire was in the same house but 30 feet away?
I think, again, if the circumstances, if a totality of the analysis, of you know, under those circumstances, then the answer is always going to be due to change, right? Like tweaking one little fact could always change the entire analysis. And I think that the trial court was very conscientious of that. I mean, he even says, you know, I recognize that this is not an analysis, and I understand it might seem, you know, extreme to suggest, or I don't want to paraphrase, I have this quote, but he basically is, to paraphrase, he's saying, I don't want to create this bright line rule, and I understand that it's a fire scene, but that doesn't mean that you always have exigency. And when you look at the urgency of the situation, when you watch the officers acting on camera at the time of the search, there was no urgency. The time that it could have taken to secure a warrant wasn't actually offered by the state into evidence. And in State versus Lewis, back in 1989, this court said, we are troubled here because no effort was made to secure either a written or telephonic warrant. We're talking 36 years ago.
Well,
30 years ago.
You dispute the representations we heard from the state in terms of the estimated amount?
No, I don't. And I think essentially the court kind of took judicial notice of how long it might take, because the court even says there was ample time to get a warrant. And that wasn't because the court's looking with 2020 hindsight. It's because this court said previously that you're not looking at 2020 hindsight, but you're also not going to put blinders on, right? So we're not going to ignore the conduct of the officers. In the case that I'm referring to, it was State versus, that was Manning, and it was the officer's actions within the next 3 days. Here we can look at the actions of the officers at the time of the search. The officer's actions at the time of the search belie this claim of exigency, because
is this about the demeanor? Because it seemed like that was a big argument, that the officers exhibited a calm demeanor and they weren't screaming and they weren't acting frantically, and so there could not have been an exigency. Is that part of your argument?
That's one way to frame it, yes. But I think it's also the fact that the officers are standing, there's five officers in the immediate vicinity of the garage and driveway area. They're guarding this area. That's one of the factors, right? Can it be under surveillance? It was under very active surveillance. There was crime scene tape. It was an entire crime scene that was set up.
But that's to keep people out. That's to keep others out. There's surveillance in that situation can control somebody appearing on the scene and taking the evidence. But we're talking about surveillance against a fire that could spread or could cause firefighting activities involving tens of, you know, hundreds of gallons of water to destroy this evidence. So how could they possibly have standing around looking into the garage prevented that from happening?
So I think, again, we can't assume, right? We can't overgeneralize and say, what could have happened with the fire? What would have happened with the fire? Maybe if an ember flew out and landed on the garage and something, this court in State versus Manning has said, we have never held that a generalized concern about a public or police safety or the preservation of evidence would justify a warrantless search or seizure. Generalized fears do not meet the standard. The detective in that case was unable to articulate anything more than a generalized concern for public safety and the preservation of evidence as the reasons for not complying with the warrant requirement. And I think that's really what we have here. I think what we have here is a lot of generalized concerns. Specifically, Sergeant Malone, all he testified to was, I was concerned the evidence was going to be destroyed, that it was going to be burned off in the fire. And there were probing questions asked by the state and the court. And the state said, well, you know, you have to, can you articulate what those concerns are? And he simply said that the fire could have spread at any moment. And then he said, there's always a risk. Fire is unpredictable, right? These are generalized concerns about fires.
Aren't they also true? Fires are unpredictable and they can spread. And so if a house is on fire, isn't it true that the fire might spread to a different part of the house?
It is always true that fires can potentially be unpredictable. It is not true that in this case, it was established that this fire was unpredictable.
But isn't it even more true when there is evidence of accelerants? And in this case, there was evidence of accelerants. So, I mean, you talked before about generalities. That's understandable, but there are some specifics that do seem particularly relevant to this issue. And when there is evidence of accelerants, as there was here, it is more likely then, isn't it, that a fire could spread rapidly and the situation could change quickly.
I think actually that weighs against exigency as far as the officer's actions belying the exigency, because yes, there's a gas can right in front of the garage. You can see it on the body-worn camera, it's right there. There's a car with burn marks on it because of gasoline. They never moved that evidence out of the scene. There was no exigency that evidence was at risk. I would imagine if there was a risk in the area, the officers would be more concerned about the gas can being ignited than the DVR system in the garage. But I also...
They could photograph the gas can, and they did.
They can't fingerprint it. If they lose it, they can't dust it or get DNA off of it. Those are really the more critical components of the evidence than a simple photograph that it was there. If we're trying to find out who did it, which, going to Justice Hoffman's question earlier, is a critical part of this case. So again, exigency being the general test. But aside from that, Tyler and Clifford make clear that it does matter what the object of the search is. So in those cases, you have firefighters with police assisting, performing their official duties, extinguishing the fire, investigating the origin and the cause. And as they're doing that, if they come across evidence in plain view, then they can seize it. And sometimes the firefighters are seizing it in the cases that follow, the persuasive authorities that we cited. And sometimes police, quote, step into the shoes of the firefighter. So if the firefighter comes across evidence and they don't feel comfortable, officer to grab it for them.
But isn't Clifford explicitly not an exigency case? And that specifically the Supreme Court at page 291 says, in its petition for certiorari, the state does not challenge the state court's finding that there were no exigent circumstances justifying the search of the Clifford home. Instead, it asks us to exempt from the warrant requirement all administrative investigations into the cause and origin of a fire. We decline to do so. So that's the Supreme Court's very clear holding. What the state wants is an exception for all administrative investigations into the cause and origin of a fire. You don't have to think about exigency at all. We are not going to grant that blanket exception that has absolutely nothing to do with exigency.
Yes, that was the purpose of addressing the case, but nevertheless, they still discussed that regardless of exigency, if the object of the search is to look for evidence of a crime as opposed to evidence supporting origin and cause, that's an important distinction, because once you have police officers looking for evidence of a crime, a warrant would be required. And here—
But did they say that in the context of exigency? That's why I'm asking, because I agree you are making a distinction that if you're searching for evidence of a crime, you always need a warrant. Whereas if you are just searching for whether or not how the fire was started, you don't. I don't see that in the cases as a factor related to exigency. I see that as a factor related to the fire is out. When can you keep searching without an exigency? That's what Clifford explicitly states. We're talking about when can you keep searching without an exigency?
Yes, agreed. And they just therein distinguish between, I think, police officer conducted searches versus firefighter conducted searches. And here, if this court agrees that we're not dealing with a cause and origin investigation, and we are acknowledging that the only objective of the search was to get evidence of a crime, then yes, the only test that applies is the test under Manning. And I would submit that the court appropriately applied those factors and found that the totality of the circumstances demonstrate that at the time the officers entered the garage and seized the DVR system, the situation did not present an objectively reasonable immediate need for warrantless action, that the officers' own conduct further reflects the absence of any perceived exigency, that the officers were on scene, visually monitoring the property, the DVR was in a fixed location, subject to no imminent threat, in an area of the home where no suspect was acting to remove or destroy it. While the state suggests that the unpredictable nature of fires justified immediate seizure of the DVR, the record does not establish any specific imminent threat to the evidence at the time of the seizure. The state's argument that the volatility of the scene created an ongoing risk is not supported by the record, which shows that the DVR was stable, secured, and subject to officer control. The DVR was fully observable, not an act of danger, and could not have been secured by obtaining judicial authorization. And when we look at the standard of review, we know that we defer to the trial court's findings. The trial court in this case had the benefit of getting the feel of the case, listening to Sergeant Malone's testimony, as well as the other officers from the prior hearing 6 weeks prior, as well as watching the video, as well as looking at the photographic evidence. And we know from State versus SS that this court and appellate courts defer to the how a trial court is interpreting that evidence as long as it's not clearly mistaken. I mean, in State versus SS, you had the same video and the trial court and the appellate court disagreeing about whether there was an invocation. And here, I think, yeah, reasonable minds can maybe disagree about whether this factors should be interpreted or this conduct could be interpreted this way. But unless it's clearly mistaken, which I submit it's not here.
It's factual findings.
Yes.
That's factual findings we're talking about. We're not talking about the application of the standard to the facts as found by the trial court.
Yes, of course. But that includes how the facts of this case apply to the factors, like how those are interpreted for each factor.
So the critical fact in this case, I would suggest, is that you have an ongoing fire feet away from the DVR. In circumstances like that, can you really have, using your words, specific imminent danger that you can point to with a fire that is ablaze?
Of course, you always can. You, if
specific, meaning how close, how far, how much time before it might engulf an area nearby, that kind of specificity is capable
being made? I think what you can always have are facts more specific than what we have here. You could have an officer testify, the fire was on the other side of the house, but I overheard on the radio that there was strong wind gusts and it was heading north, which was the side of the fire, or the garage rather. I talked to a firefighter and he said, yeah, the garage is at some risk. You might want to grab what's in there if you want to. You could have firefighters testify. I was actively working on the fire and it was still ongoing.
So you have to have an analysis, an ongoing on the scene in that moment analysis of the level of risk to the garage in order for an officer to be reasonable in going in and taking the DVR.
It's, as well as an exchange of information about that analysis in the moment.
Not always an exchange of information. I think the officer can use his common sense, but he can't speculate. He can't overgeneralize. And if he does, if we're suggesting that you can never, right, well, then it's a per se exigency rule. Then it's per se, because then essentially what's being suggested is, well, as long as the house is on fire, the cops, the police, law enforcement, they can go in and they can seize, have carte blanche and seize whatever they want. And I don't think that that's what our law would allow. I don't think that that's what this court would allow. So at some point, you have to draw the line, right? Even if it's the same building, even if it's the same structure, at some point you have to say, yes, there's a maybe there's an ongoing fire over here, which I don't think is super clear from the record. And, you know, I go into that in the response brief to the AG. I think the trial court had a lot of questions about the status of that fire.
What does the video tell us? There's a fire. As the very seconds that we're talking about, minutes and seconds that we're talking about here, there is an active, very visible, and rather dangerous looking fire in that home.
So there's
are you really disputing that the fire was ongoing?
Yes, there's, well, not that the suppression efforts were ongoing, but there's no video at the
suppression
time.
There's fire and then there's suppression. There was clearly suppression or firefighters all over the place, but that there was an active fire in the house at the time we're talking about.
So just to be clear, the fire that's seen on video on Sergeant Malone's body worn camera when he first arrives, that was approximately 35, 40 minutes before the search. So that fire is no longer active at the time of the garage search, which is why the trial court found that the exigency had dissipated. Because at the time of the search, there is no video of any fire. The only video that you have is, I think you can see some smoke, and that's why the trial court said, smoke can mean a lot of things. I didn't have any testimony before me to explain what the smoke was.
So is it the defendant's position that the fire was extinguished in the entire house?
It's not, no, that's not our position. What our position is that it's not clear and that the trial court recognized this when the trial court made findings on the record.
I thought it was agreed that there was an ongoing fire at the time of this seizure. Is that true or not?
I don't believe that it's true that there is an ongoing fire that is clearly visible. I think it's unclear in the record, but I would agree with the trial court's findings that there's active suppression efforts, there may be an active fire, but it's unclear. And I think that that's was highlighted by the court's comments at the time in the third transcript, the June 4th transcript, when he posed a lot of questions of like, I don't have enough information about this fire. I don't know what the status of the fire was. You know, that was problematic for the trial court because he couldn't make a strong finding as to the status of the fire and whether or not it posed any risk. And that's really what the record is missing below. The record is missing, A, what is the actual status of this main fire? And B, if it is ongoing, did it pose any risk to the garage area? When you watch the video, I think it seems clear, and I believe the trial court relied on that video in addition to all of the other evidence to determine that there was no exigent circumstances. There was no immediate need to go into the garage, take 7.5 minutes to climb on a ladder, go on top of the refrigerator, dig through wires, and take a person's property.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, counsel, in closing?
The only thing I'll add is just to reiterate that there has to be a limiting principle at some point. And I think here it's problematic to suggest that simply because there is an active fire, regardless of what generalizations or speculation we're making, regardless of what information we don't have, we're going to assume that because fires are inherently unpredictable, that we can always allow police officers to search a home. We have to look at the totality of the circumstances, the very unique, the very specific facts in each and every case. Here, the trial court did that. Here, the appellate division did that. Deferring to those findings below, I think the conclusion that there was no exigency and that this was an unlawful warrantless search should be upheld.
Thank you. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court. I have lots of law that I want to get into, but before I do, let me just address the factual question that was being debated. Justice Patterson, I direct you to page 62 of the third transcript, where the trial court and the prosecutor get into a colloquy about whether she ever asked her witness whether the fire was ongoing. And the trial court is doubtful that she did and says, I wanted to know the answer to that. Because I think what we have is evidence that there was smoke, which Justice Wiener, after you raised, but I think the trial court addressed head on, which is that smoke can be from an active fire or from the aftermath of a fire, and that there was the sound of venting going on, which also could be from an active fire or from the aftermath of a fire. So that's page 62 of the third transcript. But I'd like to start by discussing the firefighting function, the case law that has surrounded the firefighting function, starting with Tyler. Because the state today says, let's just rely on Tyler. But I think a straight reading of Tyler shows three different ways that this search would fail under Tyler. And there's a who, there's a why, and there's a how. So let's start with the who. Justice Hoffman, you were the first person to ask about this. And Justice Wiener, after, you pointed out that in Tyler, there was, in fact, both a fire chief and a police officer. In every single one of these cases, Tyler, and then the state court cases that have dealt with it that are on page 24 of the supplemental brief filed by Ms. Mastalone, it talks about fire officials conducting searches or police officers standing in their shoes. There is no case that allows police officers to go where firefighters aren't authorized to go or haven't gone. And we know that's exactly what happened here. The first government official to walk into the garage in this case was a police officer. The only government official to walk into the garage in this case was a police officer. So that's a major distinction from Tyler. That's the who.
Sorry, and I agree with you that in Tyler, there's a detective and there's the police chief. And so 4 a.m., fire is extinguished, everyone leaves. The detective takes the two plastic containers that had been observed. They had flammable liquid in them. They had been found in the building. There was part of a search. The detective takes them. Where in Tyler do we see that this is all about who takes the containers or because the detective was with the police chief? I just didn't see any of that in Tyler.
I guess what I'm saying is if you look at the facts of Tyler, the police go no further than the places the fire officials are allowed to go, right? They're together. We know that it's Chief C and the detective, they're together.
But the US Supreme Court didn't discuss that, for example, didn't say the detective did not step any feet ahead of Assistant Chief C.
I think correct. It's Chief C,
yeah.
Right, and so, right, Tyler also is an administrative search case, right? The first question was, is this covered by the Fourth Amendment in the first instance? Once they decided that, they reached exigency, much like they did in Clifford, incidentally, right? It wasn't the issue they were tasked with deciding, but they ultimately did. Every case thereafter that has looked at it, there is no case that I've been able to identify where the police go beyond. This court would be the first one to say police, regardless of where the fire officials are, police can go further.
Is there a case, is there a case that says that matters? I understand saying as a factual circumstance in all of these cases, the police were next to a fire.
I think there are. If you look, well, so the direct answer to your question is no. I can't find one where they say they went beyond. But in each of them, the typical situation is firefighter comes in and sees some contraband. They see a gun, they see drugs, and they say, I don't want to pick up this gun. I don't know how to do that. Let me go ask my buddy police officer who does. And then they come in, and what the courts have said is they are standing in the shoes of the fire officials when they do that. Ordinarily, that sounds like a law enforcement search that would require a warrant or exigency or consent or something like that. But they say in those instances, they're standing in the shoes. But let me move past the who.
Let me just ask you real quick. Is that because they're standing in the shoes for purposes of cause and origin?
Which gets us exactly to the why, right? Why are you going in? And what these cases allow is firefighters can go in to put out a fire. That's a pretty uncontroversial statement. But the court in Tyler said, we think you've been too narrow because firefighters' job is not just to douse the flames, but also Justice Hoffman to figure out cause and origin. And they talked about that as a safety concern, right? You want to know whether it's an electrical fire because that might rekindle if you don't shut off the electricity. You want to know if it was a candle left burning or a crock pot, those sorts of things. That's cause and origin. That is the purpose that Tyler and its progeny have deemed acceptable. But they're very clear. Once you're trying to do a criminal investigation, the who, that's a different question. And here, I'll direct you to the second transcript, page 104. We have very clear testimony from the sergeant. I thought we would lose this DVR and our chance to know who lit the fire. Right? He's wondering the who.
But
not-
it's the I thought that the DVR would be damaged. Where in the Supreme Court cases do we see that if you are worried that evidence will be burned by a fire, but the reason that you're interested in that evidence is to perhaps find out who started the fire, you still cannot seize the evidence from a burning building?
No, you most certainly can, Justice Wanderapper. And let me be clear. There are traditional principles of exigency that say to preserve evidence or to protect human life, you can dispense of the Fourth Amendment or Article 1, Paragraph 7's warrant requirement. I'll talk about those in a minute. What I'm talking about right now is what Tyler created, which it said, we're going to look at something a little bit differently when we're dealing with the firefighting function. And that requires it be the right people for the right reason. And then this is the easiest one of all. The critical thing is all these cases say when a firefighter or a police officer standing in their steps is on the scene and they see contraband in plain view, they may seize it. So what that tells us is the plain view exception to the warrant requirement applies. Direct you for a second to Arizona v. Hicks. If you remember, that's the case where police are walking through an apartment and they see some stereo equipment that they think might be stolen. So they turn the stereo equipment slightly to read the serial number, which confirms it's stolen. And the US Supreme Court says that manipulation of the stereo, the fact that you turned it to read the serial number, means that the contraband nature of the material was not immediately apparent, and therefore the plain view exception does not apply. If you can't turn a piece of stereo equipment, you certainly cannot take a ladder, climb on top of a refrigerator, and reach around.
They're not relying on plain view.
But these cases, the firefighting exception cases, require you to rely on plain view. They don't say if there's a fire that you're looking for cause and origin, you can search the whole house. It says you can seize what you came upon in plain view.
Again, that's all once the fire is put out, which is why they're not talking about exigency.
Right. So now let's
moving to exigency.
Okay, but I just want to be clear, because there was the talk today was Tyler gets this done for the state. And it simply does not. So,
and the state also says the Manning factors get it done for the state.
And we'll talk about it. And to be fair, I think in the state's moving papers, they said fire is essentially inherently exigent. So Justice Hoffman, when you were wondering what separated this from a per se rule, I had the same question in their moving papers. But today we hear that it's the Manning factors.
Today and in their supplemental brief. I mean,
they didn't file a supplemental brief.
In their briefing, they talked about the Manning factors.
Okay. So let's talk about the question here. The question is, did they have enough time to get a warrant? So I want to just say a couple things. One is the burden. This is the state's burden. And so the absence of evidence, the fact that we're not sure how many feet you subtract from 60, that's a failure of production on the state's part. That we don't know how long it takes to get a telephonic warrant at 5:30 in the morning, a failure of production on the state's part. And I take the assistant prosecutor at her word. She's a terrific lawyer and honest, but that's not in the record. The record does not reveal how long it would have taken. And that can't be held against Mr. Canaro. That's held against the state because—
That's one factor. How about the others?
Sure. It is certainly true that as flames are licking the wall, you don't need to ask a firefighter, do I need to be worried about what's on the other side of the wall? But that's not the case here.
Let's start with one, the seriousness of the crime under investigation.
That's not really up for debate. This is a serious crime. I don't think anyone has ever countered that.
Two, the urgency of the situation faced by the officers.
And so there were factual findings made by the trial judge, factual findings that are entitled to deference, that they said some of the right things, like this was really urgent, but that their actions belied that. And one thing that we know is there were about 30 officers on the scene, and they were standing around. There were officers standing around. That's 2T, page 179.
The trial judge did find the officers credible.
Yeah, because they
were well-intentioned. So
without a doubt. But those things are not contradictory to one another. The officers were credible and well-intentioned, and that doesn't mean that they followed the Constitution. That's not a finding that he made. He said they were credible, so they might have subjectively believed they needed to take quick action, but the test is whether they were objectively reasonable in doing so. And what the trial court said essentially is, when you've got firefighters standing around, before you're going to make predictions about what's happening with the fire, again, when it's not clear, because we don't know whether there was an active fire or whether it was largely out, we don't know whether the gas line had been cut or not, what the trial court found is, ask a firefighter. It doesn't have to be the senior person on the scene. Ask anyone. And you don't need them to quantify the percentage chance that an ember, if they say, I'm worried about it, we'd have a very different case. But this,
with all your experience in Fourth Amendment cases, Mr. Shalom, is the demeanor, calm demeanor versus screaming and frantic demeanor, a relevant consideration? I ask you to just in general tell us whether we should be looking at a video and seeing, are people screaming? Are people, have they lost control of the situation, or are they calmly going about their police business? Is that relevant?
So I think it is relevant, but not dispositive, which is to say one thing, two things. One is, we expect the police officers are not going to be frantic, that they're trained professionals and they're going to kind of take their job with seriousness. So I don't think we would hold it against police officers that they're not yelling and screaming, though sometimes their yelling and screaming might be a fact that the state would introduce to show the urgency of the situation. But I don't think
it seems to me the trial court did hold it against them.
I think
against them personally.
No, of course not. Of course
he made a point of saying that they're well-intentioned and credible, but that was a factor that affected the court's.
I don't think it was their calm demeanor, Justice Patterson. I think it was the fact that they were goofing around, that they were laughing at their colleague who fell off of a ladder. That's not the same as calm demeanor, right? Because calm demeanor might be something that you get from training and you get from experience. But goofing around suggests you're not as worried about flames about to overtake the building. I know I've been up here a while. If I can just have 30 more seconds on the Attorney General's arguments on consent. Those arguments, if the Attorney General were a party in this case, there are two reasons why those would be inappropriate, because either they weren't advanced at the trial court, so they can't be raised for the first time on appeal, or they were advanced and then abandoned. So they would be inappropriate if a party were advancing it.
And just observe that it seems to be that the amici are the ones who are most focused on this argument.
And I'm simply asking the court not to consider it, because I love bringing up new arguments, and the court is quick to tell me that that's not my role. And when I'm here as an amicus, I don't have the ability to supersede the county prosecutor and actually take over the case, which the Attorney General had forewent and then asked to take on these issues. The last thing I'll say is, I understand the allegations in this case are incredibly serious. But we have long-standing principles of search and seizure jurisprudence, including deference to trial court factual findings, even in light of the videotape. And Justice Patterson, your last colloquy with Ms. Mastalone about whether there was an active fire, and you saw in some body-worn camera some pictures of flames, really illustrate why we defer to the trial court factual findings, because they're the ones who sat through that whole hearing. They understand the chronology, and they're findings. So obviously the court's findings that this was not exigency are legal determinations, but each of the components that undergird that legal determination are factual findings that are determined, that are entitled to deference.
I want to make sure I understand that, because I think it came up a couple of times. Are you arguing that each of the subsidiary six Manning factors are factual findings, and so we have to abide by however the trial court decided each one?
No, I don't think I would go that far, Justice Wainwrapper.
So the threat that the evidence would be destroyed or lost, that is a Manning factor, but it seems like you're also arguing that it's a factual finding to which we must defer.
No, I don't think you have to defer to that. That strikes me as a hybrid, right? There's these component factual.
That's what I was trying to express. If it's a hybrid, if it's an application of a legal standard to facts,
then we're not deferred.
Then are we supposed to defer to the trial court in saying that, you know, for example, let's say hypothetically didn't say that, but let's say the trial court said the crime wasn't serious. I know everybody agrees it was.
Yeah,
but let's
correct. Say trial, not entitled to deference.
Not entitled to deference.
However, when the trial court finds that the state failed to produce evidence that the fire was ongoing, that's a factual finding entitled to deference. When he finds that the officer's behavior belied their professed concern about the urgency, that is a factual finding entitled to deference.
Counselor, are you saying that the Manning factors are applying facts to law, or are you saying that the Manning factors are answering factual questions?
I think it's the former. I'd have to go through each of the seven, but certainly when you ask, was it a serious crime, that is applying facts to law.
And when you ask, how much time would it take to secure a warrant?
No, I think that's a, I think that is a factual determination.
So I guess the answer would be
both. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for reminding me of the one of those factors. Unless the court has any further questions, we'd ask you to affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Otero, brief rebuttal. Ask that at some point you address what the record tells us about whether the fire was ongoing at the time of the seizure.
That is actually the first thing that I wanted to bring up in my very brief rebuttal. On page 25 of the state's appendix, it's page 14 of the lower court's findings. The lower court finds the main fire in the attic and the southeast corner of the residence remained active. That finding is supported by the testimony from Sergeant Malone that can be located at pages 104, 120, 127, 184, and 198.
Sorry, can you just say those one more time?
104, 120, 127, 184, and 198. And the only other thing I wanted to address is just this argument of that Tyler somehow applies to who and not the totality of the circumstances. In Tyler, there is a second search or secondary search that is suppressed that occurs some 20 days after the fire was suppressed in that case. That search was conducted by a police officer only. It was a state police fire arson investigator. And Tyler suppresses that not because the status of the investigator is a police officer, but because the passage of time has negated exigency. Clifford, again, while it's not a exigency case, at page 294 addresses this, this idea of exigency when it reaffirms that they're not going to apply a per se test. They say it's exigency, and they only diverge between how they talk about fire investigators and police officers in that a fire, they say a fire official investigating cause and origin only needs an administrative warrant, whereas a police officer investigating the arson needs a search warrant. And that is the only time that it diverges.
How do you reconcile, if you do, the six Manning factors that are the general exigency test imposed by this court and the Tyler and Clifford causes analysis, which appears to derive from a different line of reasoning and line of cases?
I think they're easily resolved because they're just, as this court's looked to Riley and to other cases of the United States Supreme Court, looked to Schmerber and Missouri versus McNeely when determining what exigency should be in a specific fact setting. It doesn't jettison the Manning factors, it complements them. You know, there's nothing about Missouri versus McNeely that would dispute this court's finding in Zalkberg.
Is it all about, is the relevancy of Tyler and the urgency of the situation faced by the officers?
I think it's most relevant to that factor, correct?
I just want you to speak to two calls that weren't made, because it's what's sort of bothering me.
Okay.
One call is to one of the Sergeant Bowen's colleagues to say, find out how long it would take to get a warrant. And one call is to one of the fire officials to say, we're thinking about going into the garage, find out if that's safe.
First, there's not testimony about how long it would take to get a warrant, but there is testimony from Sergeant Malone that he believed, based on his training and experience being a police officer in Monmouth County, that he didn't have time to get a warrant. That's at page 129, 183,
it's 5 and 185. In the morning. You don't know who's awake. You don't know who you can get. You know, it's a little bit of an unpredictable time, right?
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. But again, like he believes that. And there's no, I'm not trying to supplement the record with my by answering Your Honor's question. We know from State versus Witt, from the pilot program, how long telephonic warrants take, and nothing has changed that. They do take time. They take, as the judge here found, the trial court here found, would take more than the 7.5 minutes it would take to get a warrant. I understand that, Your Honor, when we look at this fact pattern from, you know, the courtroom, and there's four attorneys and seven, the smartest attorneys in the state all arguing on it, we could think about different things that the officers could do. We can think about, well, could the officers have contacted a firefighter to ask about their safety? And I think the reality is that's exactly what our precedent and exigent circumstances is always warned against. And just general Fourth Amendment principles, when we look at that, we look at what officers did, not what they could have done, when determining whether or not that conduct was reasonable. Ultimately, I think here, what we do know from Sergeant Malone's credible testimony is that he believed that the fire mitigation efforts had changed the calculation with regard to the risk for his officers. Whereas when he first arrived, he's telling them, I don't want you to show me what's at the garage. It's not safe. I think he specifically tells them that you don't have, we're not equipped to handle this type of fire. And that once he sees the fire trucks on scene, he can hear power tools being used. He can see the hoses going in. He's taking a mitigated risk, which is what we ask police officers to do all the time. I know much has been made about the demeanor of these police officers, but exigent circumstances is not excited utterance. And we expect our officers to act like the officers did here, calm in the face of danger and to take risks. It's about mitigating those risks. And at that point, Sergeant Malone had made the calculation whether he knew exactly by talking to a fire official who's busy engaging in other conduct, who he knows he hasn't been able to get in touch with. He knows for certitude that it's safe for them to go in. What he does know is that he's willing now to take that risk, because we ask police officers to take those risks all the time. Again, it's about mitigated risks, not no risks. And ultimately, with exigent circumstances, we're talking about the possibilities and probabilities of evidence being destroyed, not certitudes that we can all have now standing here and debating it.
Mr. Otero, before you sit down, can you tell us if a date has been selected for when jury selection begins?
The trial attorneys are here, so they'll correct me if I was wrong. Yeah, January 5th is the currently rescheduled date for trial selection.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We're